Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is an exciting day. It's the day one, the first day of this Rohatsu Sesshin at Mountain Gate in December. Actually, I think it's December at this point. We start always on the 30th of November in the traditional schedule. And it's a rather odd December because it's not very cold. It's rather sunny and warm. But then global warming seems to be coming forth. At any rate, the most important thing is, while not shutting down what it feels like with the warm breeze, with the sun on your shoulders as you're going up to the Kanondo for a meal or for rest later in the day, to not shut any of that stuff out. You're not dwelling on it, and this is really important. The great Zen master Hakuin was so absorbed in his practice that as he and several other monks were traveling on foot between temples, and they were passing Lake Biwa in Japan, which is considered an especially beautiful place, he didn't even notice that he'd passed the lake. And I want to say a little bit more about this, because that was a natural unfolding of his work and his practice. And it was not a fixed attempt to shut things out in the interest of his practice. And there's a really, really big difference, and this is not necessarily understood even now in Western Zen. Our normal instructions, inherited from Japan, and they're also prevalent to a certain degree in Korea as well, are simply to cut everything away that's not just the focus of the practice. Generally in Rinzai it's the koan, but in many cases a person has a natural koan, a deep yearning to become free, or a question about life. Is this all we get? We're just born, we die, and that's it. Somewhere in between that we try to have fun, try to survive, deal with stuff that comes to us, and then it's all over. What is it all about? And of course, the Buddha's classic experience with this, being raised in a very harmonious environment and never getting to see anything outside the walls of the compound he was living in as the son of the leader of his clan, suddenly went out and was shocked by what he saw. He didn't know people got old. He didn't know people got sick. He didn't know people died. Although his own mother died essentially in childbirth, she was dead 3 days later, I believe, his aunt, his mother's sister, stepped in to take over the job of raising him, and it was doubtful that he was told later that the reason that this person was not his mother, because he grew up assuming she was. And so he had no reason to wonder what happened to his birth mother. So he went out, and in each succeeding night he saw someone who was sick, someone who was old. He saw a corpse, which is quite common to see even now in present-day India. And then he saw a spiritual practitioner, a mendicant. So the shock of the first three sights, horrifying as they were for him, were mitigated by the sight of the person in spiritual practice who radiated peace. And because of that, he had some hope that maybe, the horror of what he'd seen and what was behind it. You know, is this all we do? We get old, we get sick, we die? That perhaps there was some deeper understanding that he could reach that could be free. And so he left the compound, cut off the long hair that was the sign of his rank, and dressed in the servant's clothes who had accompanied him out into the forest, went about his way and connected with a group of people who were doing spiritual practice. And the spiritual practice of the era was ascetic practice, at least the one that the Buddha to be connected with. And there are still people in India to this day doing ascetic practices, mortifying their bodies one way or another, sleeping on beds of nails. There was one man that one of our Rochester Zen Center pilgrims encountered in India who had been for 20 years bent over with his head in a hole in an attempt to have some kind of spiritual opening. And this Sesshin is the one in the year that is memorializing the Buddha to be, the young Shakyamuni, his efforts and his course of work, his path, really. And eventually, after 6 years as an ascetic, he was near death from this self-mortification, and he decided, since his particular practice apparently was eating extremely little, he decided that if he kept on, he was going to die. And he hadn't any answer to his questions about why. And so he decided to take some nourishment. And karma being what it was, a young woman came by with it's called rice milk. It's really the rice washing water. And that was exactly the thing to break his fast, because if he broke it with a fabulous meal, he probably would have died right then. So he drank the rice water, and then he decided that what he needed to do, since he had not found anything outside, that he would have to focus inside, because the answers had to be there. And so he vowed to sit down, happened to be cross-legged because that's how people sat in India in those days, and not get up until he had his answers. And another serendipitous event happened. There was a man who was selling straw or cut grass, and he saw somehow, was connected with a deep determination of Shakyamuni, Buddha Gautama, Siddhartha, and gave him enough of this soft cushioning that he could sit on. And it is said that he didn't rise for 7 nights and 8 days, because he became increasingly absorbed in his quest. And becoming increasingly absorbed in his quest, the energies, and they are our own energies really, that draw us away from our practice came forth. And the story, as it's told, is that Mara, who is considered the Buddhist devil, and again, these devilish phenomena are creations of our own mind. They are attempts to distract ourselves from deepening practice, and they come at certain points in time, which we won't get into, but the response is the same as what happened with the Buddha. The first thing that Mara pulled out of his pocket of tricks was his beautiful daughters, who danced and were coming on to this young man, trying to entice him away from his practice. And he just ignored him. He was so intent on finding his answers that even beautiful women were not particularly tempting to him in those days. And the next thing that Mara pulled out was pain. And many of us are familiar with this in terms of our practice, since we do sit cross-legged or bending our knees in some form or another, generally speaking, because that's what we inherited in terms of the practice form. And Westerners are not normally sitting like that. We sit in chairs. So the image is of demons hurling boiling mud at him, and lances and spears. And that, of course, translates into pain in our knees, pain in our backs, pain everywhere, perhaps, ankles, whatever. And again, he ignored it because he was so much more interested in, so much more committed to finding his answers. If he had tried to shut out the pain, if he had tried to shut out the images of the beautiful women, it wouldn't have worked. He might have been able to focus still, but he would not have become as free as he did when he did become free. And the last and the biggest thing that Mara pulled out was, you're not worthy. You can't do this. You don't have what it got. And to answer that, he touched the ground in witness. And the witness came forth in the singing of birds, in the sunshine shining, in the cool breeze blowing. And Mara gave up. And it's like that for us too. When we encounter these periods of makyo, as they're called, if we simply take a glance, okay, well, I have better things to do, and then dive in more deeply, then eventually they will just fade away because they have no energy building on them. It's typical in Rinzai monasteries in Japan and in other parts of the world to share Hakuin's Rohatsu exhortations. Every evening he gave a little talk. Sometimes it was quite short. And these have been translated by the premier translator of Hakuin, Norman Waddell. And so we will share with you his talk on the first night. This is Hakuin's instructions to monks for Rohatsu Sesshin, the first night. The master said, to practice jhana, which is meditation, of course, you should sit yourself on a thick cushion, loosen your robe and belt, and assume the full lotus posture. After straightening up your spine and settling into a comfortable position, which sounds a little counterproductive given that we're sitting in full lotus, but anyway, this is 18th century Japan. You should begin counting your breaths. The breathing exercise is foremost among all the countless samadhis. And this is why it is the main form of practice here. The extended out-breath that was taught by Hakuin and is considered to be the actual practice that the Buddha himself was doing when he had his great awakening. Before that, there weren't any prepared koans such as mu or sound of one hand or original face. It was a person's natural koan, and his natural koan was, is this all there is? We're born and we get old and we get sick and we die? There's nothing else? And it's interesting that Kapiloroshi, who was a court reporter after the Second World War, at the end of the Second World War, in fact, he had enough of a court reporting practice that he was called upon for the war crimes trials, the ones in Nuremberg in Germany and the ones in Tokyo in Japan. And in fact, I think one of them, I think it was the Tokyo one, he was actually the head court reporter. And he had a chance then to see the reaction of two different, vastly different cultures to the trials, to the accusations, and to the trials that were subsequent to those accusations. And he was quite struck by the fact that the Germans, as he put it, were angry about it. Why me? You know, why are you blaming me? But the Japanese were incredibly apologetic, willing to accept whatever verdict was handed down to them and to move on. They thought, what is the difference? Why are some of these people caught in their own stuff? I don't know if you would have put it that way back then. And what is it about the Japanese culture that allows them to accept their fate, their karmic comeuppance, if you will? And so another thing happened as well. While he was in Japan, he had here and there some free time, and he would spend it in the gardens of the Buddhist temples. And he was so struck by the degree of peace in those places and by the degree of awareness and attention that when he went back to the States, he wanted to learn more about Zen. And so he started taking courses on Buddhism taught by D.T. Suzuki at Columbia University. And eventually what happened, after a couple of years of that, was that his fellow students started saying, apparently he was advertising these courses and trying to explain them to people. And they said, look, either do it or quit talking about it. And he decided to do it. So he sold his business, sold his possessions, because he had this sense that if he didn't do that, that he would have some reason to come back. In other words, he burnt his bridges to, and these are his own words, he's burnt his bridges to coming back so that he would have to stay. And that is something of a practice. In one way or another, we burn our bridges. If we're going to be truly committed to long-term practice that brings results. And so he went to Japan and through his good karma encountered the right circumstances and the right teachers, and 13 years later returned to the United States ready to share his understandings and his way of working with students, if anybody was willing to practice with him. And he had done a sort of a pilgrimage before settling on where to settle down. He'd gone to Southern California and been welcomed by the Vietnamese community. He had gone to various other places, and he finally settled in Rochester, New York, which is not known for its fine, gentle weather. And he decided on Rochester, New York because he figured it would be so nasty outside, which I can verify, that people would be willing to come inside and do the practice and search within themselves. And that has proven true, largely. The Rochester Zen Center this year celebrated its 50th anniversary. Many, many people arriving there, celebrating the history of the place and their ongoing practices possible the place. And he settled up in Rochester at an era when there really wasn't much guidance in Zen practice. It was a brand new thing in America. People didn't know how to do it, and the number of authentic teachers was less than the fingers of one hand. And now, unfortunately, two of them have been shown to be not as fully cooked, one might say, as they had given the impression they were, and had been ousted because they had been abusive to their students. So, continuing with Hawkwind, after straightening up your spine and settling into a comfortable position, you should begin counting your breaths. And this is for new people, because if you've been practicing for a while, you can let go of the counting of the breaths. When you are able to focus on the extension of the out-breath on a regular basis, there's no need anymore for the counting. And you want to let that counting go, otherwise you're applying something on top of your practice. It's important in the beginning just to help develop some attention to the practice, but once that role is fulfilled, then you can abandon that counting. And it's important to do so, as I said. The breathing exercise is foremost among all the countless samadhis. When the cinnabar field, and that's translated by Norman Waddell as the tanden, this place in your belly, just below your navel. Below the navel, fills to repletion with vital energy. Start working on your koan. Cut life off at its roots. If you continue practicing like this over the months and years and are not remiss, your kensho is assured, as certain as reaching down and touching the earth at your feet. Strive hard. Strive hard. Now, a couple more comments. The breathing exercise is foremost among all the countless samadhis. When the cinnabar field below the navel fills to repletion with vital energy, you want to allow your awareness to sink into your hara. It's as if your awareness is seated in your hara. For Westerners, we usually think our awareness is up here. And that's really the machine room. The true awareness, the ability to expand our awareness beyond words and thoughts and ideas, is from the hara or the tanden. Those of you who've done martial arts are aware of that. And it's important, just for our own grounding, to practice living from our hara. When the cinnabar field below the navel fills to repletion with vital energy, start working on your koan. And for many people, the koan really is what brought them to Zen. Some sense that there's something beyond our normal cognition, our normal awareness, and that it's important to get back to whatever that is. Or we've had a loss or a death, and it's shaken us to the core. Where has that person gone? What happens to people when they die? For a man who was in the Normandy invasion in Europe during the Second World War and survived it, returned to the United States 6 months later, his life koan was, how can there be such suffering? How can it happen? Why does it happen? And he was so caught in that search for his answer that he couldn't hold a job. And he spent the next 6 months walking the streets in New York City, so absorbed in that life koan that he'd bump into street poles and so on. And then after 6 months, it opened up for him. But unfortunately for him, he had no way to nurture it, to deepen it. Nobody knew what he was talking about, and so it became a dim memory. The reason we know about it was because 20 years later he came to Kapil Roshi. Somebody sent him there and said that you might be able to find some help there. Kapilarishi listened to his story and said, if you start doing meditation, it's likely to come back to you. But he never heard of the man again. So very likely the man did not do that, because there was no other opportunity, really. So we have our life koans, and that's the most potent kind of koan to work on. There are the classic breakthrough koans. Monk asked Joshu, does a dog have the Buddha nature? And Joshu answered, no. And that's a conundrum in that everything has the Buddha nature. And yet, there's nothing that has the Buddha nature. So how can you address the fact that something is and something isn't at the same time? And for Westerners, the Mukwan is a little bit of a challenge anyway, because we don't think about whether a dog has the Buddha nature or not, because dogs are wonderful little puppies. We love to have them in our house, unless we've been bitten by one. And so it doesn't have the same punch that it did in Joshu's era in Japan, in China, during the golden age of Zen, the Tang Dynasty, when dogs were considered truly wretched creatures and no one would have one in their house except these little Pekingese dogs in Peking. But in general, dogs were wild and filthy and full of sickness, as they were in Burma when we lived there. And it was nobody's idea that they might even possibly have the Buddha nature. What is this exalted thing that we are, as human beings, supposedly have? Surely they can't have it. They're so dirty and wretched. Which is why Joshu said no. Which surprised the monk, because previously he had said yes, dogs do have the Buddha nature. But again, it is not a koan of choice at Mountain Gate, because it is just, it's an artificial situation for Westerners. And in fact, Hakuin himself quit using it. He found that the sound of one hand was much more effective. There's less to latch onto with that. There's another koan, which comes out of the experience of the sixth patriarch earlier in China than Joshu, where once he got transmission and was given the robe and the bowl, he was chased down by one of the monks who had been a general and before he became a monk. And the general realized that he was barking up the wrong tree in a certain way, that perhaps the sixth patriarch really had received the bowl and the robe, honestly. And it happened when he tried to lift the robe and the bowl off the rock where Enno had placed it, knowing that someone was about to approach and grab it from him. And it really floored the former general that he couldn't even lift him up. And so he said, really, I didn't come for the robe or the bowl. I came for the teaching. Please teach me. And so initially, the sixth patriarch said, well, let's do some zazen first. And they sat, and as they got deeper and deeper and more quiet in their minds, then Enno said, when you were pursuing me, thinking of neither good nor evil, where then was your original face? When you were thinking of good, neither good nor evil, where was your original face? So focused Monk Byo was on the tracking, on the search, that was filling his universe. And he wasn't thinking about why he was going or what he had to do when he got there, or whether Enno was legitimate in having the robe and the bowl. He just was so focused on the search, that it naturally triggered an awakening for him. And so that's another koan, and it's normally voiced as, show me your face before your parents were born. Your face before your parents were born? Come on. How did I figure that one out? Well, dive into it. But it's important to recognize in the working on these koans, if you are assigned one of these koans, that it's not used to barricade yourself against the world, against sensations, against the environment, because that's not the way it's meant to be worked on, certainly not from Americans. It's important to allow yourself awareness. And this expands into the moments when we're not sitting on the cushion, so that when you're working during the work period, there is just the work, of course, but you're not shutting out anything else. You're not shutting out whether it's chilly or warm. You're not shutting out where the sun is, whether the sun is shining or not. You're not shining out whether you've got enough light to work. If that happens, you just go and get a flashlight or something, or turn on a light switch. It's difficult to express, but the traditional teachings are to cut everything else away. And it's not about cutting everything else away. It's about the fact that you're so absorbed in what you're doing. And when we're working, that natural instinctive sense of wordless questioning is still going on. It may not be going on in a way, and it should not be going on in a way to interfere with your work. If your work is such that it requires attention, and all work really is, then attention and awareness is vital. But shutting out, deliberately shutting out everything else, is a misunderstanding of how to practice. Because Hawkwind continues, cut life off at its roots. This is through this absolute awareness and attention. Naturally, cuts off our ideas, our thoughts, our assumptions, and we come into a very much more clear place in our minds. There's a lot more to this, and we go through it in Sanzen, but those are the basics, really, in terms of doing the practice effectively. And when we do it that way, as Hawkwind says, we can't miss having Gensho any more than we can miss the ground touching it at our feet. Some of the translations say stamping the ground with our foot. So we now have 6.5 days. Well, 7 days, because we go all through the night, the last night, and into the morning of practice, allowing yourself to deepen and deepen further and deepen further, letting go all the temptations to distract yourself. Initially, they can be big, but it's important to tune into your body and feel the yearning to understand, to deepen, to find your answers, to live fully. And if things come up for you, because things may, to tune into the energy flying around in your body, not to try to suppress anything. This is vital. At the same time, we're not going the other extreme and inviting it in for tea. We're not chasing it. We're not embroidering it. We're not lounging in it. Things come up, tune into the energy in the body until it dissolves. And as part of that, you can also wonder wordlessly, who is it that is feeling this? It could give you some insights. And at the least, if you work with it in that way, it will cease to be a problem. Now, we come to practice wanting deeply to become liberated and understanding at a certain level that that will happen if we persist. But then we go along and the practice begins to deepen and we begin to get a little concerned. Sometimes anxiety can come up. Sometimes it's just these devilish phenomena that we use to try to dissuade ourselves from the practice. And then it comes to a point where we tend to, it's like driving a car with one foot on the gas and one foot on the brake. It's not going to go very fast anywhere. Whereas if we took the foot off the brake, we could reach our destination much more quickly. And the same it is for practice. At the same time, again, we don't want to shoot it out of the water. We want to tune in. We want to dare to feel whatever comes up, and it's usually anxiety. And if it gets too much, back out a little bit, then go in again. As you do that, and it may take a while, for me it took about a year before I was able to cross that half-frozen lake on my ice skates in my mind. And suddenly I realized that anxiety wasn't a problem anymore. Sort of like it had no bite anymore. And then the practice could go much deeper. But I don't know anybody who doesn't have some level of resistance come up to the practice. And it can be with anxiety. Anxiety is really at the root of it because some part of us understands that we're going to have to let some pretty significant things go. The most significant being an assumption that we are somebody and all that goes along with that. Because if we're not somebody, how on earth are we going to figure out how to behave in society? Well, that tends to take care of itself. I wouldn't worry about that. Nonetheless, we do. I think this is enough for today. You've got a good foundation to start on. Now, let's go deeper. And then deeper, and then deeper. Don't let anything stand in your way, like water, flowing water, isn't stopped by the bamboo. The clouds in the sky are not stopped by the mountain peaks. But they're not trying to beat down the mountain peaks. And the water is not trying to cut the bamboo down in order to flow. It simply responds by moving around the obstacle. And it's like that. It encounters the bamboo. It doesn't say, get out of my way, bamboo. If it could talk, it more likely would say, oh, well, let's find a different way around this. And it's not trying to get it out of the way. It's flowing, tuning in, allowing. And right then, even in the midst of a difficult sense in our body, if we tune in fully, the breath can suddenly go very, 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 very deep. I leave this with you. I thank you for listening. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.